Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back on the show Dr. Richie Shoemaker, who is the author of Surviving Mold, Life in the Era of Dangerous Buildings. I initially interviewed Dr. Shoemaker on his book Mold Warriors years ago, and it really changed the way I practiced surgery here at Plasticos. I was seeing a lot of women extremely ill from saline implant disease, and Dr. Shoemaker's work, especially in the realm of chronic neurotoxins, helped me understand how this was very different than the chemical toxicity, also combined with mold toxicity we were seeing in the silicone patients. But this book, Surviving Mold, Life in the Era of Dangerous Buildings, has shown me that Dr. Shoemaker has been very busy since 2005 extending the science, and it's just really a pleasure to have him on the show today and talk about one of the most covered up areas in politics, which is mold biotoxin and the particular predilection of some individuals to have a massive inflammatory response when exposed to these biotoxins. Welcome, Dr. Shoemaker. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for providing the invitation. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope your listeners know that you were the first one to recognize fungal colonization and contamination of saline implants, and since I learned from your work, it's helped an awful lot of people who otherwise would have gone undiagnosed.
Yeah, I think anybody who has a foreign body, foreign material in their body, and we don't even know all of the implications. I mean, there's all sorts of silicone-based and also other-based, like chin implants are made of proplast. But in any case, anything that's put in the body and maybe even retains sutures can act as a repository for microorganisms, including mold. And in fact, when I go in some of these metal implants, you see this dark, gooey stuff around the implant and in the screws. Of course, the patient's having symptoms, and you just wonder about how common it is for biofilms to form around any of these materials and then make the patient ill.
We've known for a long time that biofilm formation is a big deal for people with prosthetic hip replacements and knee replacements, as well as valves in the heart. The big player has been an organism, a coagulase negative staph, that in years gone by was a simple skin contaminant, and a lot of people said it was no big deal. What we now know in the profuse biofilm forming coag neg staphs, there are released into the environment a number of compounds that are genomically active. And what that means is that these organisms sitting in biofilm, seemingly not doing too much bad to us, are actually turning on some genes of inflammation that we don't want to have turned on and turning off others that we'd like to have turned on. This idea of a benign quote-unquote organism changing genetic activity, I think, is a huge forefront. And there's a lot of talk about biofilms, but we know full well in one organism that the science is already there on differential gene activation associated with colonization.
And this means that not everybody who is exposed to, whether it be a biofilm in something implanted in them or a sick building where there's been water intrusion problems and we've got a kind of a whole different, in each building may have different organisms growing. Part of the problem is that not everybody exposed to these gets sick. And that becomes a defense of the powers that be and of the administrations of these places, anywhere from the CDC to the EPA. I like the story in your book about the guy that worked at the EPA. you and I shared a patient who got sick at the CDC. So
yes, we did.
So basically, all of these administrations say that because everybody's not getting sick, it is very difficult to show or they hope that it's very difficult to show that that your patient's getting sick from this building. But I know that, you know, what you've done is develop a whole bunch of very objective laboratory data, visual contrast sensitivity data, all of these things to show that the patient is sick, number one, and that with re-exposure into the same environment, they get sick again, and that is helpful in terms of the legal cases.
One of the critical concepts to keep in mind is that the illnesses that people acquire following exposure to the interior environment of water-damaged buildings is an inflammatory illness. When we talk about inflammation as a response to injury, the injury in this case is inhalation of a variety of compounds we call antigens. And these antigens basically are molecular structures that say, I'm made by a virus, I'm made by a fungus, I'm made by a bacteria or actinomycetes. But these foreign compounds, these little structures, are recognized by what we call pattern receptors. These pattern receptors are part of our host defenses that say, I recognize I'm being attacked by pattern A or pattern B. And there's a whole host of these. No one receptor will do all of the surveillance. But once there is detection of a foreign invader, the host response isn't just a, you know, one little bit of molecule response for one little molecule of invasion. It is all hands on deck. And that host response in the normal person, the person with particular genes that don't get sick from water-damaged buildings, that host response will result in formation of a protective antibody, and the antibody will clear the antigen, and once removal from exposure is accomplished and the antigen's removed, there is no illness. The people that get sick, it's incredibly important to know, have a genetic basis from HLA-DR, part of chromosome 6, that says, I'm not going to form an antibody to protect me. So even with removal from exposure, the compounds that are recognized as being foreign are not eliminated. They have structures that make them small, and they're not eliminated in stool or urine, and most assuredly they're not going out in urine. They're not going out in saunas. They're not going out when you cough up something out of your lung. They stay in you, and successful treatment of these folks, in addition to removal exposure, comes from binding of particular toxins and inflammagens, and there's a whole host of these things beyond just plain toxins. But the innate immune response, the host response, once initiated, must be identified and corrected sequentially, one step at a time. And we have protocols that do that. And eventually, we can now, fortunately, now restore immune equilibrium to the folks who were previously permanently injured and give them their health back. It's truly a golden era of treatment in these chronic inflammatory response syndrome patients.
Yes, we have women who get breast implants, and because this genetic susceptibility may be up to 25% of the population, if they are exposed to mold, and we've had them exposed with anything from being in a contaminated building, their house, their office, even their car, to sleeping on moldy mattresses after Katrina, to using scuba diving equipment on a honeymoon. There's many ways to get mold exposure, as you know. But once you breathe in the mold, if the mold itself is active and gets into the bloodstream via the respiratory system, it can land on any foreign body that we have through that biofilm mechanism. And then it starts growing there. I mean, and I know the first time I interviewed you, when I told you that we were finding mold, you know, around the breast, especially in the saline of the breast implants, we send it off to Micometrics, a lab in New Jersey that you often use too. You were saying, oh my goodness, I bet those women are really sick. And the answer is, yeah, they're really sick. They come in wheelchairs sometimes, can't walk.
One of the critical issues looking at that cohort of people is the sickest of the sick, about 0.9% of the population, are going to have one kind of gene makeup, the immune response gene from HLA-DR, that's called 11-3-52B. And these people usually are long and slender. They could be equally at home on a basketball court or on a runway modeling new clothes. It's interesting, when I was watching the Olympics with the swimmers, you look at a number of these swimmers with their incredibly long arms and long legs and long fingers. You say, well, gosh, this helps them with their flexibility. And Michael Phelps is just a classic example of that. But Missy Franklin is as well. The likelihood that people with these body habitus types are associated with HLA-DR 11-3-52B is accomplished by overproduction of a compound, a cytokine, called transforming growth factor beta 1, or TGF-beta 1. So when you see long, slender habitus and, as expected, the HLA at risk, and TGF-beta 1, TGF-beta 1 will attack a variety of structures in the body, including neurons and the wheelchair people you talk about, the MS syndrome-like patients, the funny people with peripheral combined immune variable deficiency, and people with demyelinating disorders of one kind or another. Expect to find high TGF-beta 1 and low levels of particular lymphocytes called T lymphocytes that are regulatory. And if they have low levels of T regulatory cells and TGF-beta 1, here will be your neurologic people. Here are your unusual lung people with asthma that doesn't respond to standard asthma treatments, with hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and the list goes on and on and on. So we're not looking so much just at people in water-damaged buildings. We're actually looking at the link between genetics and body habitus and environmental factors.
Yeah, I'm going to start ordering more tests. I mean, back years ago when I was ordering a lot of MSH, that was right when LabCorp changed its values. And I just love what you said in the book, you know, because I called them up too. I talked to the director of the laboratory and said, hey, wait, you know, you can't change these because, you know, 35 to 80 is normal, but less than 35 is not normal.
Right.
And, you know, I got the same answer that you put in your book, which is, I guess all the doctors were ordering them just on the sick patients so that LabCorp changed their normal range to what is really abnormal. But that just goes to show you can't always trust a laboratory value either, especially if it's not rational.
I have LabCorp send me, when I get my results, anything under 35 is critical. So we have the LabCorp fake normal range of 0 to 40 with critically low written on the same lab slip.
That's good.
A bit comical. But LabCorp has done the same thing with other labs that I use as well. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, am I just being singled out here? But the VEGF normal range should be 31 to 86, and they have 0 to 115. You can't walk around with no VEGF. They
of course
change.
Not.
You can't. And then they change C3A.
It's not even logical.
C4A. Yeah, really. Yeah,
it's okay to have a zero hormone level. You know, come on. Why does the body have the hormone?
And then some physicians will look at those results and say, well, they look pretty good to me.
That's right.
Fortunately, you know, our group in September published over 2,000 adults, and we have over 500 kids, and just an awful lot of controls. So those normal ranges are not determined by a laboratory. They're actually determined by real-life people walking around on Main Street in Pocomoke.
Yeah, well, that's what's important. And it's important also to understand that if you do have the genetics, which are basically estimated at 25% of the population, and then some of the real severe genetics are, what, about 3% of the population?
Right.
Or less?
43, 53 are the worst ones. They're 3% of the population, and I mentioned the one, the 11-3-52B, that's less than 1% of the population. And yet, if you look at the refractory folks with chronic fatiguing illnesses, they're the disabled people, the folks that are on SSI or some sort of help because they just can't go, you will find those people, well over half, have these fairly unusual haplotypes. So it's kind of a thing that, you know, if any of your listeners are being told they have chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, or if they're being told they're depressed when they're not, you know, the mechanism to get the answers really starts with objective parameters. And by the way, the labs that I use are all listed on the survivingmold.com website, and any physician or patient can download the list. It's got the test codes and everything else you need so that your physician can order these tests easily. They're all covered by insurance, and it makes identification of sick people reproducibly reliable. You mentioned 24% for the HLA frequencies in populations. You know, I published that number back in 2003, and it has stayed constant since then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was right then, it's still right now.
Well, and it's very important for the listeners to understand that up to 25% of the population, if they are repeatedly exposed to sick buildings or sick cars or sick whatever environments, they will become sicker quicker, and this is the term that you have coined, which I love. In other words, what used to take maybe a half an hour being in the building, now within 2 minutes of being in a building, the people can identify that this is a sick building. And what I want the listeners to understand, both Dr. Shoemaker and myself have this disease, both of us. I can walk in a store and within sometimes 40 seconds tell you that there's mold in that store. I can eat something that has got mold in bread or mold in the food, and I know right away that I've ingested mold. So this is something that we have figured out mainly because we have the illness, and some of Dr. Shoemaker's real serious problems are outlined in the book, the bleeding problems. He can tell you more about that, but the chronic exposure to mold in buildings can lead to bleeding problems because of the decrease in antidiuretic hormone. And he has to take that with him wherever he goes.
One of the things to keep in mind when I say an inflammatory response syndrome, this name comes from earlier literature when people had infections in their bloodstream called sepsis. And we know that in sepsis there are inflammatory responses, host defenses, that involve cytokines, that involve what we call pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. Then there mm-hmm. also is what's called Th17 immunity, not Th1 or Th2. And this is where TGF-beta-1 starts playing a big role. We know that there is a tremendous abnormality in activation of complement, one of the most important of the primordial defense mechanisms we have. And there also is involvement with coagulation. This is not new science. This has been known, you know, since the turn of the 20th century. And the interaction between bleeding disorders that you see in some of your unfortunate, maybe not your unfortunate surgical patients, but those of other physicians, come directly from this cascade of interacting events initiated by antigen detection and antigen processing. So as we go forward, one of the goals, and I think we're making good progress here, is to turn off this basic failure of antigen recognition. And we can do that now using replacement with vasoactive intestinal polypeptide. And if you're not familiar with this use, Dr. Kolb, boy, I really need to show you the data here. There's a paper on surviving mold that we put forth in September 2011 looking at some of the worst people with disabling chronic fatigue treated successfully, not just short-term, but over 18-month follow-up, so that we have durability of effect and benefit and durability of absence of side effects. It's, in a way, it's almost like the parents of a child with type 1 diabetes. It used to be that was, you know, dreaded. It was almost a death sentence. You knew the child was going to be in real trouble. And the parallel to that now with VIP deficiency is that we can actually give that to you safely and legally to make a tremendous benefit in people once the inflammation is just taken care of. If you still have exposure to water-damaged buildings, If you still have evidence of a visual contrast deficit, if you still have one of these unusual coagonic staphs, and you take VIP, you're not going to get better. So patient selection is important, but for folks like you, you shouldn't have to suffer, I certainly don't anymore, from being in a building for just 1 or 2 minutes.
Well, that's great. No, I mean, I need to learn about VIP. VIP is given as a nasal spray, and you mentioned earlier in the book that you had an institutional review board to use it. I mean, is that necessary now, or is it? Can we use it off-label?
Well, yes, you can use it off-label. It's compounded for me by Hopkinton drug. The reason to have an institutional review board, look over a proposed study protocol, is that human mm-hmm. research is very tightly regulated, and with input from a variety of scientists and ethicists, it almost is a requirement for publication. If you don't have approval from an IRB or independent review board, people are going to say, "Wait a minute, you know, we don't really trust this." So mm-hmm. now that the multiple papers have been published on VIP. Then it is now something that it's not on a list that says you may not compound it. It's kind of a double negative, but that's the FDA mm-hmm. for you. But nonetheless, if you have pulmonary hypertension, that is the indication for use of VIP. And by the way, mm-hmm. pulmonary hypertension that's acquired is so common in people with these inflammatory response syndromes. And then VIP there is not only restorative of control of inflammation, but it's also life-saving.
I think we need to tell the listeners a little bit that when people have these chronic inflammatory responses to these mold biotoxins, a huge number of systems are affected. The average number of symptoms that a patient has when they come to see me or Dr. Shoemaker is really 30 to 40 different symptoms. They've usually been to at least 20, sometimes up to 99 doctors. Many doctors have told them they don't know what they have, but they're going to die from it. You know, it's just really, really an incredibly complicated disease. It affects the metabolic system. We cannot get the Krebs cycle to work right, and so exercise, if you try to exercise, you might spend 3 days in bed because of a disruption in that. It disrupts the immune system, it disrupts the neurological system, and it disrupts the endocrine system. And in some patients, the pulmonary system, if you're having reactions that we just talked about. So, and it actually, in my patients, it's so interesting, the heart is also affected by the biotoxins. It causes a bunch of different but similar, you know, in just a few categories of electrical disturbances because the biotoxin is a neurotoxin. And then these clear up once we do the explantation, treat with antifungals, and do biotoxin detox. So, you know, so I think it even can affect the heart. The good news is it doesn't affect the heart or lungs in a really bad way so that surgery is dangerous. But I will say this. I will say that without desmopressin, which we have to give to some patients who are bleeding excessively, we would have a big problem with bleeding. So the ADH deficiency that leads to the bleeding that Dr. Shoemaker had when he has developed nosebleeds when he goes in these mold toxic buildings can also occur on the operating room table. So it's very much important for your surgeon to understand the metabolic consequences of the disease, because it can affect blood clotting, and it can also make blood clots more likely in the postoperative period as well. So we have to deal with that as well.
One of the things to keep in mind about ADH is that the synthetic form of that called DDAVP is a compound that curiously stimulates release from the margins or boundary areas of blood vessels of what are called the monomers or single agents of von Willebrand's factor. These monomers are joined together almost like a plastic polymerization situation. We call them multimers. It is the multimers that link together like multiple crosshatches over a break in the lining of a blood vessel that then attracts platelets and all that. Now, that polymerization is blocked by high levels of C4A, which is a product made by complement activation, so that if you find someone bleeding in your surgery and you give them DDAVP successfully, which ear, nose, and throat people have done for years, and it's a cinch that it does help, and it's almost benign in what it does to you, is that there should be almost immediately a knee-jerk response that says, measure von Willebrand's profile, measure C4A, measure TGF-beta-1, and these people are all going to have MSH deficiency. So that seeing bleeding, and say the surgeon hasn't taken a good history, for example, and they don't know that the school that they go to is moldy, seeing the bleeding should be a tip-off then and there of where does this come from. Now, since there are some people who do have von Willebrand's disease, you know, it's not...
Well, they usually know they do, though. You know,
the acquired form, they don't.
And right, but the genetic form know it because, you know, unless they're adopted.
It's interesting that when I looked back in 2004 at the data of why was I hemorrhaging 6 and 7 units of blood, not just a little nosebleed, the question of where was this von Willebrand's problem coming from, at that time the two biggest series were from Italy looking at people with acquired von Willebrand syndrome. And there were two series that had looked each at over 100,000 patients to come up with 10 cases each. And in my first 1,000 patients who I measured von Willebrand's profile in, we had almost 60 patients, I think it was 58, in the first 1,000. So the ratio of bleeding disorders in moldy patients to non-moldy patients is huge.
Yeah. So that's the importance of taking a look at the lab data, too.
You know, if you order before surgery a PT and a PTT or an INR, you just won't find the information. It doesn't take too much more to do a von Willebrand's profile to help people out. But, you know, you mentioned symptoms. So many physicians are pushed for time, I think, or their eyes might glaze over when someone says yes to the first 20 questions of are you tired,
right.
Do you feel weak,
right, yeah.
It's like, you know, I hate to tell trade secrets, but words like gomers get used by some physicians, and we all know what gomer means. It means get out of my emergency room.
Right.
You know, there's almost a bias, a prejudice against people who have multiple health symptoms. They come from multiple systems, and the exciting thing is that if we assume for a minute that these people aren't all crazy and trying to waste our time, you will find people that you can help. And correcting some of these complex illnesses has been, quite frankly, some of the most exciting parts of medical treatment that I've ever seen.
And you know, the prevalence of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia is just staggering. And then to think of all the people who are diagnosed with post-Lyme's disease, which may also, in many cases, be the chronic inflammatory component rather than the actual spirochete growing. That's
exactly correct. That's very, very
interesting. Right.
You know,
go ahead.
The Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, published in January of 2011 their estimates of the incidence of water-damaged buildings in the U.S., and they estimate that almost half of the U.S. buildings have water intrusion and microbial growth. This is a giant problem. And if you think about school districts now with funding being cut, you've got a flat roof building with some sort of tar that only lasts for a few years on it, and there's water leakage in the kindergarten pod, or the school has to get a temporary classroom that they kind of screw on the back of the school, and then there's ongoing leakage. You know, if we go into those schools like we did at Lanier Junior or Middle School in Fair Fairfax, Virginia, we can assess teachers, staff members, and students pretty quickly. And what you find is a large number of people that are being told they have one disease or another. They walk around saying, oh, yes, my asthma just is real bad, or, oh, yes, I'm tired because I had a little bit of anemia, and, you know, I've been stressed, and I really have put on some extra weight. And people will accept these half-hearted diagnoses as
right,
the final word.
Right. Yeah, and because of the genetic diversity, the disease patterns can look different. And that's what people have to understand.
One of the things we know full well is that the problem doesn't come from moldy buildings, from a pile of leaves composting in fall. It doesn't come from the garden soil that's been sitting there. Sure, there are fungi there, and sure, they're similar to the ones we find indoors, but the ecology of an indoor water-damaged environment is completely separate from the ecology of an outdoor environment. Fungi break things down. They're decomposers. They rot. And what they do is make foodstuffs available to other critters, bacteria especially, that live around fungi and say, thank you very much. I like it that you gave me amino acids and sugar from those complex molecules I couldn't digest, and I'll now take those. It's that competition for this free energy or free food that we find outdoors, for example, that we don't find indoors, that lets fungi now have extra energy or money, if you will, to make the expensive molecules, the secondary products of metabolism. There are mycotoxins or fungal toxins, but there's also inflammagens and beta-glucans and mannans and hemolysins. Might not be words everybody uses every day, but they are more likely than not to be far more important than mycotoxins alone. Added to that, in that same environment, there will be some gram-negative bacteria that say, I will work synergistically with fungal compounds to hurt immune responses even more, and then add in actinomycetes, these organisms that are kind of in between fungi and bacteria, that say, we also will be synergistic in damage to the host. So that it's not, you can't do an air sample, for example, and say, everything's fine. When you're looking for intact spores, you need to look at the fragments of spores, you need to look at bacteria, and you need to look at these actinomycetes, because they're sure looking for you.
Right, right. I wanted to mention, too, I had one patient who Mycometrics said she had penicillamine in her inside her saline implant, and every time somebody hugged her or somebody did a rough breast exam on her, she would start to have an anaphylactic reaction. She was allergic to penicillin.
Oh, man. That's
I know.
The case you'll be writing up.
No kidding. No kidding. Yeah, that's true. I wanted to tell a story and see what you thought about this. I had water damage to my home during the floods that Atlanta had a few years ago. And, you know, we called the mold people in and they did the normal treatments of the crawl space. But then it came back, which sometimes it can do. And I had interviewed Dr. Edward Close, who was an environmental engineer whose wife was an aromatherapist. And he'd done a bunch of studies showing that thieves, which is an essential oil put out by a cold diffuser, could kill mold. So I went ahead and did that. I added a little menthol to it, too, because I know how mold doesn't like menthol. And I put cold diffusers down in the crawl space. And because I'm such a great barometer of mold of mold problems in my house, I can tell you it worked really well. So I started just using it like once a week in the bathroom, because the bathroom down, I had a lot of trouble with mold growing in the, you know, in the pipes beneath the faucets and in the tub. So just doing that once a week kept the bathroom clear as well. Have you tried that? Because that might be something that could be used. Some of my patients didn't have to throw out their stuff, you know, when they were able to do that and keep their stuff, their clothes, their papers and everything, because it permeates pretty well.
After the first few people said they had benefit from the thieves' oils, I actually had looked at the next 20 consecutive patients, and the story is not quite so rosy. From our data based on your happy event, the issue comes back to, are we killing something to make an environment safe. Well, I mentioned spores, intact spores, as one thing that might be measured by an air test. I don't know too many people relying on air tests anymore, because for every intact spore, not to mention one that will grow, provided you use one of the three selective media that you have to use, you will find 500 particles that are simple dead chemicals. And those particles are going to be breathed in the air, whether they're living or dead. So all the thieves oil and all this or that, it's just not going to deal with the need to clean reservoirs of particulates from the air, from possessions, and from floors, ceilings, and walls. Now, you mentioned crawl spaces and basements. I think probably 95% of homes with these structures are likely to have microbial growth. But it used to be we would want crawl spaces to be ventilated in summertime. And then, you know, when houses are built and they're three or four blocks high and you see these little vents along the sides, it's interesting that thinking has gone completely the opposite way from that. Now what we want is to have essentially swimming pool liners put down on the soil in crawl spaces, continuing all the way up to the sill plate, and we want no air movement at all getting into the upper floors from the crawl space. So this sealing of a crawl space is critically important, and gosh, I cringe every time I hear someone in a home and they've got HVAC ductwork and equipment in a crawl space, and the crawl space has got a the dirt floor or one that's not sealed, because over time, especially the flexible fiberglass ducts, they will become wonderful areas to grow microbes. And the growth is in the middle of the fiberglass, so you won't necessarily see it. Or if someone has some sheet metal where one piece joins to another, those junctions should be glued together and then screwed and then, you know, double taped and wrapped, because otherwise there's going to be air infiltration. And if you're bringing in air from the crawl space into your ductwork and you distribute it throughout your home, someone's going to say, my roof doesn't leak. I don't have any plumbing problems. Right. How come my hole is so moldy?
Right, right.
So, you know, looking at all those things, you know, I wish that the thieves had been the whole answer, and I think it could be part of an answer, but you've got to clean, 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 and you've got to remove the potential for exposure. So sealing off crawl spaces and making sure that your roof doesn't leak is obvious first steps.
Yeah, and I think there's benefit, too, just by having the machines that clean the air, you know, the ones that like HEPA filters and stuff like that, in either whole house, or what I've done is just put them right by where I sleep, and it just cleans the air in the room. And so, you know, where
most
I spend
of my
most
patients
of the time
will go to one of these big box stores, and whether it's Lowe's or Sears, and spend about $150 to get a portable HEPA filter. They've got a 0.3 micron pore size. And if you think about it, why is the pore or the opening of this filter so small? Because spores that the air samples tell us about are 3 to 8 to 15 microns in size. What we're after are the fragments. That's why the HEPA filter pores are so small. And golly, for a limited amount of money, because each one of these units will do about 2,000 square feet, assuming a 8-foot ceiling, you can have one upstairs and one downstairs and be filtering your air 24/7. For folks with prior mold illness, that's not an option. That is mandatory.
Yeah, that really is. That's true. So what other areas do we need to cover?
The big deal where we are now is looking more carefully at this host inflammatory response. If you have a new protein appearing in blood, it had to get there from activation of a gene found on DNA and then transcription of this gene so that a messenger RNA or a messenger molecule takes the genetic message out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm of the cell, says, okay, make a protein. And we call this generically genomics, because now that we can assay 22,000 genes, which is what the human genome has, we can then tell you of sick patients versus control about 1,700 genes that either are upregulated or going too much, or downregulated or going too little. From that, we have refined a total of 250 genes of the 1,700 that let us have a fingerprint for what mold illness, as I call it generically. This is the inflammatory response syndrome from water damaged buildings. We now can tell you with one tube of blood whether the person has an illness that came from a water damaged building or not. We have a patent on this just recently applied for, and this is going to be a new era, because now with just one tube of blood and not 25 or 30 tubes, we can get far more sophisticated information. But what this new research has shown is that, unfortunately, the old model from Watson and Crick, you know, about DNA being a double helix and all these genes are transcribed to messenger RNA going out to the ribosome in the cytoplasm for ribosome RNA and then a protein, that missed a big step. What it missed is regulation of mRNA through what's called microRNA. And Dr. Kolb, I'm not sure you know, but for your listeners, this is the future of medicine, because we can now have direct genetic modulation of gene activity to have targeted and safe treatments that will go at the very fundamental basis of why do these abnormal proteins appear in the blood. It is incredibly exciting. Quite frankly, it's been 5 years of research from my point of view, and just before the show we were talking about what's new. Well, genomics is what's new. This is going to revolutionize healthcare as we know it today.
That's fabulous. How are we going to get this information out to all the doctors, though?
Well,
as you know.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We started work on the patent on April 2nd, and only recently, last week, in fact, you know, was it now completed? So I haven't been able to talk about it. And your show is this the first time this is going out to the public. So I'm incredibly excited and grateful for the invitation, of course. But as you learn more about your patients, you know, we don't think twice about doing a CBC. We don't think twice about, you know, looking to see a SED rate if we're worried about a kind of arthritis. I think we're going to be doing these gene activities routinely. One application is in our chronic pain patients. People that need to have opiates all the time and, you know, fentanyl patches and all this stuff. And if they don't get their pain meds, these people are in real trouble. Nationwide, the oxycodone problem and prescription drug abuse frequently is tied to chronic pain. It turns out, genomically, on particular kinds of cells called B lymphocytes, there are an incredibly enhanced density of particular markers, we call them CDs or cluster of determination, that single out our chronic pain patient who's going to be needing opiates before they need opiates. And opiates don't increase these CD markers, but the idea is that we should be able to target these CD markers, remove the excessive amount, and the hypothesis is that chronic pain is going to disappear. Now, obviously, this is very early in the research, and it may be completely wrong. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, for a few target patients who we've done some CD manipulation, we see pain syndromes resolve. If we look at what we can do with microRNA, for example, with hepatitis C, I don't know any physician that's treated hepatitis C that has cured a patient. We measure messenger RNA for hepatitis C in blood and find 5 and 6 million copies routinely. There is a microRNA that targets the hepatitis C mRNA and stops it from being produced. And people with microRNA are treating hepatitis C with fantastic results.
That's wonderful news. I mean, there's a whole, I don't know how many, probably millions of people out there with vague diagnoses and, you know, on the long-acting pain medicine. And basically, they all end up on Social Security disability and Medicaid, and, you know, that eventually
Or jail.
Because they are jail or they can't work. So that's wonderful news that
as we go further with what's new, as we go further, we of course have to have validation from other mm-hmm. workers in the field. We have to have reproducibility. And the work has to make sense. The good news is the technology we're using is readily available. It is not mm-hmm. new in itself. It's not something that we have to reinvent the wheel here. This is the application and the data analysis and the computer time that goes into these things is just phenomenal. But to be data mining a data set of 22,000 points sorted by C4A, sorted by TGF-beta-1, sorted mm-hmm. by coagonic staff, biofilm formation, is kind of stunning in just thinking about doing such a thing. But that's what we've got.
Well, that gives me something to do. I can start measuring TGF-beta-1, C4A. I can ask LabCorp to do their critical thing on the ALF-MSH again.
Yeah, for sure.
VIP, VEGF, MMP9. One of my patients, who was the wife of an ophthalmologist, had critically low VEGF levels.
Yep.
And she, in fact, very, very critically low, infected moldy breast implants was the cause. She actually had a retinal detachment, and her husband told me that there's information in his literature that low VEGF is associated with retinal detachment, which I didn't know. That was something new to me.
There are a variety of VEGFs. When we found the VEGF deficiency was a big deal in these mm-hmm. patients, and coincidentally, it is the dominance of low VEGF that I feel is associated with a reduced incidence of cancer in my cohort. We've looked at over 8,000 patients, and we don't see as much breast cancer. We don't see as much colon cancer. We don't see some of the hematologic malignancies the same way. And if you think about it, the treatment approach to some cancers involve drugs that are antagonists to VEGF. This so-called anti-angiogenesis movement
was
begun by Jonah Falkman. Like Alexander Fleming, he left a tissue mm-hmm. Culture plate open overnight, trying to show how to slow down growth of epithelial cells, and he couldn't do that, but needed to do that to show benefit in cancer modulation. Sure enough, he came back after the weekend, and all of his endothelial cells were ruffled, and they looked like they were dead. And in the middle of it was a Aspergillus fumigatus fungal compound growing, releasing a compound called fumagillin. Fumagillin mm-hmm. was the first of the anti-angiogenic agents, and basically what it does is knock down VEGF. When you knock down VEGF, you affect blood supply to every cell in the body. VEGF deficiency is part of a syndrome that needs to be fixed. We can fix that with two different approaches. So you're right. Retinal detachment is one thing, but so is macular degeneration. So are some of these funny blindnesses that people see. So will some of the migraine-like syndromes that people have. Fixing VEGF is a big deal.
And certainly shortness of breath. I'd say the majority of my patients who have saline implants with mold problems in or around them are short of breath, especially after having, like I said, a mammogram, a vigorous breast exam, or somebody hugging them too tight. They get sick for a couple of days after that. So you have kind of
one of the things that goes along with that shortness of breath is change in the type of cells that line bronchial tubes. Here, our mm-hmm. friend TGF-beta-1, or transforming growth factor, transforms nice, mm-hmm. soft, delicate epithelial cells into thick, tough, fibrous tissue that just doesn't
right.
move properly at all. So in addition to the acute episodes with a hug, you also have chronic issues as lung tissue is remodeled by TGF-beta-1.
Yeah, so that's, as I said, yeah, it's a toxin, and there's a variety of toxins, and then there's also what we've been talking about all hour long, which is the body's particular genetically induced response to these toxins. which you learn pretty early in life if you have that. You usually get a diagnosis of fibromyalgia or some other fatigue illness, and it just gets worse the more often you're exposed. So,
You know so much about this field, and my hat's off to you. For some of your listeners who aren't up to speed the way you are, it might be helpful to look at the survivingmold.com website. There's a ton of free downloads and a lot of information, not to mention the consensus report of treating physicians for mold illness that was published in 2010. There is so much good science that people have the option of knowing. There is a jargon that they have to get through. And when I say TGF-beta-1 quickly, some people may be turned off by that, saying, I've never heard of such a thing. Well, unfortunately, that's the coin of the realm. That's how we discuss mm-hmm. these things. But because this illness is common, because it's treatable, and because it's definable, it really is incumbent upon patients to respectfully request that the physicians not turn a deaf ear to the multiple health symptoms. And if reading Surviving Mold or even reading the book is the first step the patients can take, good. But physicians need to be educated, and patients have the right to better health outcomes than what they have now.
Well, thank you so much. Can you give your contact information one more time? Are there any other websites other than www.survivingmold.com you want to mention?
It may be helpful to look at chronicneurotoxins.com. It's a bit mm-hmm. of an older website, but it has the same kinds of information. For more information, people can always contact the office here. It's in Maryland on the Eastern Shore, 410-957-1550. We answer our phones from 9 to 2, so just call when you've got a human being to talk to, and we'll be glad to help you with information as indicated.
Are you planning to redo your diagram on chronic neurotoxins at all based on what you've learned?
Oh, yeah, sure. Like I said, that hasn't been updated for a while. There is the Biotoxin Pathway 2011 version on Surviving Mold. What I'd like to do, and if you haven't thought about it, I sure have, is getting together a group of people in Atlanta in springtime and get together a conference where people that have illness or thoughts and ideas can sit down and talk with physicians and really get better up to speed on what this illness is and what you can do about it.
Yeah, that would be a great idea. We have Dr. Dennis is here and some other doctors that are knowledgeable about mold. So that would be a good idea. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Shoemaker. It's been great reading your book. As I said, I needed to have interviewed you about 2 years ago when this came out. Dr. Shoemaker is the author of Surviving Mold, Life in the Air of Dangerous Buildings. He has not just sat on his laurels. He has actually progressed and figured out more about what is actually behind chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, post-Lyme syndrome. And in my world, women who get deathly ill when they get defective saline and even silicone breast implants. So I really appreciate his pioneering work. Thanks so much, Dr. Shoemaker. Appreciate you joining
us. Thank you. You're courteous as always, and it was wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you. Next week, we have Greg Braden, Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. And on the 18th, Eva Hare will be on with her new book, Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Super Science of Quantum Physics. She has interviewed, I think, about 20 scientists in various fields and puts together their take on consciousness. And on the 25th, we have Stephanie Marone, What the Animals Taught Me, Stories of Love and Healing from a Farm Sanctuary. Stephanie, as you might remember, is the editor of the book Goddess Shift, Women Leading for a Change, and Optimism, both of which I have a chapter in. And she is a great author and is also the author of a health series on natural treatment for mental health. Again, thank you for joining us, and we will see you next week.